Hello and welcome to the AV Forums podcast for Monday, the 5th of September. Welcome to a new month. And today we've given everybody time off and we're going to do something slightly different on the podcast. I say everybody, Steve's here.
Yes.
And we're going to go over a little event which is still actually happening over in Germany, in Berlin, and that's IFA. So Steve, this is Europe's biggest show for consumer electronics and white goods. It's more heavily towards the white goods and tech and that kind of thing rather than AV and hi-fi. But in previous years, we've always thought it's been a bit of a damp squib because basically we're seeing the tech that we see at the beginning of the year in January at CES. It's just been reshown. There's a couple of new announcements, but there's usually nothing major. And sometimes you kind of wonder why the show is as it is.
Yeah, I think it suffers from a slightly inconvenient time. I think September's ideal, given that obviously the majority of the stuff was announced back in January at CES, and there's another CES coming this January. Plus, we've also got CDU in the States, which is later this month. So that really does make the timing of this show not ideal. I think, to be honest, if you go there, it's really, really is about far more about the white goods, I think, than it is about necessarily the AV side of things. That is more of an adjunct to it. But quite often, there are some interesting things at this show. It's never going to be the same as CES, which obviously that is the show of the year. But every now and then, products that perhaps get released later in the year do get launched at CES. So it can be interesting. And whilst this year wasn't perhaps a classic, there were certainly some interesting products from the point of view of AV Forums members and us as well. I think obviously the big news this year definitely was JVC's launch of their native 4K laser projector.
Now, hang on a minute. You're saying news that would be useful for... I don't think there's anybody in the forums that can afford this thing.
Well, I have to say, at least it was cheaper than I thought it was going to be. 30 grand, I grant you, is not small change. But it's a lot cheaper than the Sony 4K native projector, laser projector, which is, what, 50, 60 grand? It's half the price. But yes, £30,000 is still a lot of money for a projector. So I don't think the majority of AV Force members probably won't be buying it, which is a shame because it's a cracking projector, naturally. But yes, it is not cheap. Obviously, I guess... developing a DLNA native 4K chip small enough to go into a domestic projector has taken some time and cost some money. The laser light source has obviously taken time to develop and cost money. And the 18-piece all-glass lens array clearly isn't cheap either. And that's been developed for the 4K resolution.
And it's wider than normal. So it's 100 mil.
It's 100 mil, yeah, as opposed to, I think it's 65 mil on the projectors they've been launching before. So, I mean, it's absolute beast of a machine. When you see it in the flesh, because you know, in photographs, it kind of looks a bit like the other JVC projectors, the same kind of basic layout, central lens, vents on either side, sort of the shape of the chassis is similar. So you think it's going to be about the same size, and then you see it. It's the size of a small family car. It's a good job
I've got a big area to put projectors on then, isn't it, Steve? Because it should fit quite nicely on there.
It is a whopper. Yeah, with a big, big lens in the middle, 100mm lens. But, you know, strangely, even though it's huge, that they've taken a lot of time designing it. It looks nice. They've used a matte surface. They were going, which is interesting because on their old high-end stuff, they used to use that gloss surface, obviously, which is a fingerprint magnet. And they've made this matte, which makes more sense. Obviously, it's black as well. They want to make it, to reduce reflections and that kind of stuff. So anyway, we had a demo of it, and it was very impressive, naturally. As we mentioned on previous podcasts, HDR isn't necessarily the best thing for projection because, you know, projectors are never going to have the kind of peak brightnesses that TVs can deliver, which means, you know, you tend to find that a lot of times on a projected HDR image, it looks very dim. Now, having a 3000 lumens laser in the projector certainly helps. And JVC have also done a lot of work in terms of a dedicated HDR mode on this projector. And the demos that they showed us, and they used, it actually supports HDR10 and hybrid log gamma. And they had some hybrid log gamma footage that they showed, which looked, I have to say, looked very good. And also they showed some scenes from a clip from Lucy and a clip from Deadpool, Ultra HD Blu-ray. Those are both HDR10. And first of all, the mode automatically detects, the projector will automatically detect an HDR10 signal and switch into the HDR mode. It can't automatically detect a hybrid log gamma signal because that doesn't have the correct metadata. So that'll have to be switched in manually. But with the HDR10 stuff, it did automatically detect it. I mean, this was still a prototype projector, I should point out. So, you know, there's a bit of fine tuning still going on as far as JVC are concerned. It wasn't the finished article. But it detected it, went into it, and as an HDR projected image goes, it's easily the best I've seen outside of, you know, a Dolby Cinema. Certainly for domestic purposes, it looked really good. Yes, it didn't have those kind of peak highlights. There was a hint of crush in some of the images, and like in Deadpool, I'm used to the clouds and the background weren't quite as well defined as they would have been on a really good HDR TV. But for projected HDR image, it looked really good. It was certainly bright enough. You know, it had the contrast in there. It had the dynamic punch. The colors... Because, I mean, this projector can do 100% of DCI-P3 and over 80% of Rec. 2020. So that's a really big color glamour. And that those colors look saturated and realistic and really good on this projector. And a 10-bit DLI devices, so not a hint of banding in the image either. Motion handling was excellent. It looked really good. But what really struck you immediately, because Lucy and Deadpool are both 4K DIs, and Lucy was shot at 6.5K, a lot of it. The level of detail that it was showing was superb, so you really can tell that native 4K panel was delivering the goods. I thought it looked really impressive. I guess people will say it should do for that kind of money, but hopefully, you know, this will filter down to
this product has to exist.
Yeah.
For that to happen.
Yeah. We have to. It has to start somewhere. And this is the starting point.
Exactly.
Hopefully, in 2 or 3 years, we're going to see this kind of level of performance in a more affordable sub £10,000 projector. It certainly is as a statement of intent, which is what this really is, isn't it? It's that JVC saying we can still deliver, you know. And it's good. I think it's really good from the point of view of the consumer, because up until now, it's just been Sony in terms of 4K native.
Okay,
4K
so let's move to Sony. If people want more on the JVC, the article is up on the homepage. There's two articles. There's the announced details and Steve's hand-on, where he goes into some detail on the viewing that they had. So if you're interested in that, they're on the homepage. So Sony, they've launched the VPL VW550ES. As I said in my review of the 520, it hadn't moved on from the 500, and it looks like the 550 hasn't really moved on either.
No. In reality, there is very little difference between this and the 520. The big difference essentially is what Sony have done is that, like JVC, they have been working quite hard on the HDR mode. Because again, they got a lot of feedback from their customers, from people that owned 520s, saying HDR doesn't look very good, it's very dim, etc. And they've always taken that feedback on board. They've developed a new HDR mode for this projector. And importantly, this mode will also be available on the 520 as a firmware update. So this is not just the 550 is going to get this. The 520 will also get this. And the 320, which has been updated recently for HDR. And they've created a new HDR mode, which allows you to actually adjust the level of brightness to create an image that you prefer. So they gave us a demo of, again, some hybrid log gamma footage that have been shot for them in conjunction with the BBC, I believe, and that looked really impressive. They also had scenes from Angry Birds. That was in Ultra HD and also in HDR, and again looked really impressive. And then they had some footage they showed of just SDR content that was a football match. Basically, their approach was very much we could first of all their demo room, unlike JVC's, which was completely blacked out. Proper home cinema. This was more of a lounge environment. They were trying to show that the projector can be used in an environment other than just a home cinema. Although obviously, if you want, you know, the optimal performance, you want to do that. But they were trying to show that to people, because obviously IFA is a show open to the public. Unlike almost all the other shows, it is available open to the public. I think Sony were trying to broaden the appeal of projectors to a wider market by showing that you could use a projector, even one like the 550, in a less than ideal environment. So the room had white walls. They had a screen that came down. And to be fair, it did deliver. You know, it was delivering a nice big bright image. It could handle that kind of environment. I mean, it wouldn't be an ideal. Wouldn't be what I personally would do. But the HDR footage looked good. It was bright. It was detailed. They were using very bright demo scenes. At least JVC did use a sort of a mixture of different scenes. But it looked good. But what I was impressed by was the fact that they were prepared to roll these firmware updates out to the older models as well. So it's not just...
Well, you're saying older models, they're all the same. They haven't moved the tech on at all. And why should they? Because they've got no competition at that price point. So they can keep the tech. They don't have to redevelop it. They just put a new model out, add a couple of software tweaks. Like you say, HDR has been improved slightly. But it's been improved slightly that allows the end user to mess about with it. Not necessarily to the standards. Sony seem to be resting on their laurels here and not moving the game on, which is, you know, which is why we need JVC launching this big 30K machine, because we need them to then be competing at this price point as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Competition is key to getting prices down. If you look at the price of the 500 series, if you want to call it that, Sony projector, it basically has been the same price now, hasn't it, for the last 3 years? There hasn't been any price reduction. It's always been £899, isn't it? £8,999. It's pretty much been the price point that this projector has been sitting at since the 500 came out, I think, 3 years ago. So, and the reason for that is quite simply they haven't had to drop the prices because they haven't had any competition in that particular sector of the market. But they also, like you say, Phil, they haven't really put... I mean, if you look at the HDMI inputs and the capabilities, they're the same as last year. Now, unlike JVC, which has the full fat 18 gig HDMI 2.0 inputs that can do, you know, 12-bit at 422/60p, the Sony doesn't have that. So I do feel like Sony need to sort of, you know, step up a gear, and hopefully JVC coming into the market and hopefully more projector manufacturers coming to market with native 4K projectors will kick Sony at the bum a bit, and they'll start upping their game slightly with regards to this, and hopefully also dropping their prices a bit too.
The Sony will be getting this one in for review, so we can actually test it. And the thing with HDR, and this seems to be causing quite a bit of confusion on the forum, Steve, HDR for projectors is never going to be the same as on a TV. They are completely different display devices. Therefore, they have completely different characteristics. They will display HDR completely different from each other. The plus point with using a projector is that you start in a dark environment, or you should be in a dark environment. Therefore, the black floor is lowered to start with. So you should get a fairly decent performance in HDR, but it's never going to be the same as a 55 or 65 inch TV, just because of the nature of the thing. It's completely different, and completely different standards as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you think about it logically, you know, a projector is using either a bulb or a laser to create the overall image. I mean, you can't get the kind of fine precision peak highlights you can with, say, an OLED TV or an LED TV with a local dimming zones and everything, where they can get down to a small level of detail and have that 1,000 nits of peak brightness. You're never going to get that with a projector. Even the Dolby Vision dual laser projector system that I saw recently only had a peak brightness of 108 nits. So, you know, for anyone who thinks they're going to get that kind of performance out of a projector, that's just a misunderstanding of how projectors work, I suspect. You're never going to get that. But like you say, Phil, in a good environment with a good lowered black floor, you will get, you know, you will still get a dynamic experience from a projected image. And obviously you also get all the other benefits that come with this, including, you know, the resolution, the wider color gamut, and the 10-bit processing. So, you know, once you add all that in, the images can look absolutely stunning. And some of the stuff that I saw on the JVC, particularly with Lucy, which is a really, really good disc, it looked absolutely stunning, you know, and you do begin to see the true potential of what can be achieved at home. And even comparing it with something like Dolby Vision in the cinema, Dolby Cinema, you know, you realize that, you know, you can still get a very similar experience, obviously for a fraction of the cost. Even $30,000 is cheap compared to what they're paying for their systems. So, it's I think, you know, it shows that there's lots of potential for the future, and it's a really exciting time in that sense.
Yeah, so people shouldn't get the two mixed up, because they are completely different beasts. And talking about OLED TVs, let's leave projection there. Let's move on. There was only one announcement of a new OLED TV that you can actually buy. I mean, Panasonic pulled the old prototype trick. The thing with prototypes is you can make them look good because you're not using mass-produced components inside them, and you're not using mass-produced software for lots of models. It's a prototype. It will look good. And in our eyes, Steve, that's completely irrelevant. What is the relevance of showing a prototype other than to say that they're working on something towards the end of the year, towards the winter, and they'll have more details later? So the only one that you can actually buy is the one that was announced from Philips, and you had a good look at that one.
Yeah, 901F. It's interesting because obviously, you know, obviously the panel is made by LG. Who else is it going to be? But so what's interesting then becomes how the other manufacturer, in this case Philips, takes that panel and then applies their own processing to it to deliver the overall image. And, you know, Philips have some very good processing. I mean, that's an area where they've been particularly strong over the years. So that was an interesting thing to see the combination of the two. And Danny Tack, who's their kind of, you know, their picture quality, picture image guru, took us through what he'd been doing with the 901F. And just for, in case you're wondering, the F stands for flat because it's a 55-inch flat OLED. There actually is a 55-inch curved OLED, the 901C, but that's purely for China. It's only for the China market, apparently. So over here in Europe, it's the 901F flat OLED TV, 55 inches, as I said. And, yeah, it was interesting. Some of his comments were very interesting because he was talking about how they'd taken the panel. And
well, I think the context really is, Steve, that Danny Tack, for a long time, said OLED had no future and the future was LED, LCD. So with that context...
He did eat some nice humble pie at the beginning of this presentation, as to be said. He said, like, I know I've said that OLED wasn't the right technology in the past. He said, but I will admit, there are definite strengths of OLED, and we all know what those are. You know, it's things like obviously the blacks, the contrast ratios, the viewing angles, and the ability to deliver accurate colours even in darker scenes. I mean, and wide colour gamma, all big strong points of OLED. And he said, but there is one downside, and it is still the fact it isn't that bright. And that we've discussed this at length on previous podcasts, and it's true. And particularly in our new HDR world, that level of brightness is becoming, or lack of brightness is becoming more apparent. And he said, yeah, it's true. He said, but having said that, he said the majority of TVs that this TV is going up against, you know, there aren't that many TVs in the marketplace that actually can deliver over up to or even over 1,000 nits of peak brightness. Most are actually around the 500 to 700 nits. Which is where this TV is pitched. You said, you can do up to 700 nits, but in a calibrated mode with D65 color temperature of white, you're looking at 540, which is the minimum standard for Ultra HD Premium Alliance certification, which this TV has. So you can deliver at least 540 nits of peak brightness in a calibrated mode. So you can go brighter than that, you said, but obviously your whites are going to look terrible. So fair enough. And he talked about things like the motion handling on it, which is another strong point of OLED. And he particularly found that he liked having that to play with his, because you know what Danny's like with his picture processing on motion. And in fact, some of the demos that he did, the motion handling on the OLED was definitely superior to the Philips LED TV he had it next to. He does have an annoying habit, though, in his demos. They're always jacked up to vivid and everything, and everything's jacked up to the max. So it's a bit difficult to really tell what a quality image is going to look like, because you need to turn a lot of the stuff off when you're actually doing the testing and reviewing when these things come in for review. But certainly he had he talked about HDR, talked about the HDR performance. He did say something which I actually initially thought doesn't make a lot of sense, and checked with the Ultra HD Alliance, and he was wrong there, actually, which is surprising for Danny. But he was talking about the requirement for Ultra HD Alliance premium certification was that it had to be able to tone map a 4,000 nit graded image content down to the TV's native peak brightness. And that, in fact, is not true. The Ultra HD Alliance told me that their TVs need to be able to do 1,000 nits down to their brightness. And that would tie in with what I've seen in terms of testing, where, with the exception of Samsung, no TV manufacturer is correctly tone mapping 4,000 nits down to their actual native peak brightness. And Danny actually proved that with his TV as well, because he was showing that famous clip from Pan where the ship flies towards the island and you can see the sun setting behind the mountain, and the distinct circle of the sun wasn't there. So I knew, and I knew that was a 4,000 nits master as well. And so I knew he was probably not on the right track there. But what he was also talking about was, and this is something that a lot of manufacturers are doing at the moment, they're doing a sort of fake HDR mode. Because, he was saying, when you had Ultra HD TVs first launched, you were upscaling to 4K because there was no 4K content. Now there's 4K content, but, there isn't much HDR content. So you've got these capabilities on TV, so you want to take full advantage of them, so you can also do a fake HDR mode. And I have to say that whilst... his example, sometimes it didn't look too bad, and I've seen other examples where it's looked quite good. I think Samsung's fake HDR, HDR Plus they call it, works really well sometimes. But at the end of the day, you are taking an SDR source and you're basically just trying to make it look like HDR. And what you end up doing is you end up blowing out.
Clip the hell out of the image.
And oversaturate the colors. Yeah. And, you know, so in my view, and I'm sure you agree with me, Phil, is if it's SDR, set your TV up correctly to show SDR the way it's meant to be seen. And then if it's HDR, set your TV up correctly to show HDR the way that it's meant to be seen. And that's the way you should do it. And I'm not really sure people should know. I know why the manufacturers do it. I know they're trying to add an extra feature. They're trying to
It's like the old vivid mode and the dynamic mode and all the rest of it, and shot mode. So we really need to be wrapping up on this. Obviously, we're going to be talking about the consequences of IFA over the next few weeks and products that were announced and so on. We'll definitely be going back to those because we expect them to be coming in for review very soon. But anything else on the show floor that piqued your interest, Steve?
Well, actually, interestingly, that although it wasn't particularly well advertised, the Philips OLED wasn't the only new OLED TV. There was also a new OLED TV from Lerva, the Build 7, which will be getting released in the UK. And that that looked very good. A very impressive looking OLED TV as well, using obviously an LG panel, of course. And this is being priced and aimed to go directly up against the G6 in terms of price point and you know features and that sort of stuff. But that looked quite impressive. It had a really cool soundbar that comes down below the TV when you're using it, and it can go back up behind the TV again when you're not. So, and that could be quite nice for wall mounting and that kind of stuff. It was certainly seemed like a more elegant solution than the sound base on the G6, for example. So that could be interesting. So, in fact, you know, we had a couple of new OLED TVs coming out. In terms of the big manufacturers like LG and Samsung, they had nothing new at the show. So what they were basically doing was talking about technology. So LG had a very interesting demo of HLG again. So a lot of manufacturers were showing HLG. That's hybrid log gamma, which is going to be probably going to be the main HDR format for broadcast.
I think it's likely going to be the de facto because SMPTE have just taken it on board, as the ITU, so it and EBU as well. So it looks like it's going to get industry support right across the board.
There was actually a demo by Technicolor at the Philips press in the Philips press room. They were showing their version, which is another version of HDR. Theirs is designed to be bit like hybrid log gamma. It's meant to be easy to implement without using up too much bandwidth and backwards compatible. But it would appear, judging by what the manufacturers were all saying and demos that they were doing and what we heard from people like the Ultra HD Alliance as well, is that hybrid log gamma appears to be, certainly in Europe and Asia, it's becoming the de facto. I don't think it's necessarily been totally agreed in the States yet, but
has the state ever done anything the same as everybody else?
Yeah, but with NHK and BBC obviously pushing a hybrid log gamma and the European Broadcast Union as well, it looks like it's going to become a de facto format. And so there were a lot of demos of that, which I have to say looked really good. And also LG were demoing high frame rate. They were showing content shot at 100 frames per second. And it was sporting stuff. So
absolutely no interest to you then, Steve.
Well, it was stuff shot at the French Open, for example. And, you know, I've got to say, whilst I would have been very curious to see how that looked for a film, definitely for sports, these higher frame rates are going to be a big thing because, you know, no question it made the fast-paced sports action look really good on it. So yeah. 100p or 120p if it's in the States. I think that's going to be a big game changer. And if you're looking at, I mean, I know they aren't fully agreed yet, but you know, you can probably guess where TV stands are going to go because Ultra HD is going to be 100, 120p, HLG, and obviously 4K is going to be the sort of the general standard.
You can actually see at the minute, there's quite a few certainly BBC productions that are being shot at 50 and 60p, and obviously being played back 25. Over the air, but you can tell it's been shot with you know 50 and 60p because it just looks so much nicer. We did our CES videos this year at 50p just because when you do things like panning around a stand or looking around a television or a product, it just looks so much nicer and so much smoother for video. And video is where it's really going to make an impact.
Yeah, definitely. I'm still, the jury's still out, I think, when it comes to movies, but no question with video, and particularly with sports, this is going to be a real game changer. So that was interesting. Samsung was showing, they were basically pushing Quantum Dot. They were talking about the benefits of Quantum Dot and how they were still going to focus on that going forward. Basically brighter images, wider color gamuts, as we suspected. They were demonstrating, interesting, the very thing I was talking about a few minutes ago about TV's tone mapping 4,000 nit content. They had, again, that same scene in Pan, but this time they had, they weren't actually showing what the TVs were, but you could work it out. It was a DX902, it was a G6, and those two were showing that Pan Ultra HD Blu-ray in HDR10. They had the KS9500, again, showing the same scene Ultra HD10, and they had the same scene showing on a G6 in Dolby Vision. And it was really impressive, really interesting, because the sun, again, that sun sitting behind it was clearly clipped on the DX902 and the G6, which I knew it would be because I've tested that scene on both those TVs already. The KS9500, no problem at all. You could nicely see the defined sun. It looked superb. Again, I know that because I've seen that scene on the KS9500. And then the same scene, Dolby Vision on G6, which again, I've seen as well because I've got that same scene on a USB stick. And to be honest, the Dolby Vision image and the KS9500 looked almost identical. There was no real differences between the two. So those people who sort of like, oh, I must have Dolby Vision, and why haven't we got Dolby Vision? And people were moaning about the fact Dolby Vision isn't on the Philips 901F. And when I asked Danny, he said, well, there's no Dolby Vision content. And, why am I going to be paying licensing fees or handing over HDR to a third party for something that there isn't any content for in the first place? Which is largely true, except for Netflix at the moment in the UK. You really don't have any, and there isn't that much Dolby Vision stuff on Netflix to start with. Everything you want to watch is available on HDR10. So
it just shows you how powerful the marketing is, though, Steve, from Dolby, because if you actually think about it, they're only on LG TVs in Europe. Vizio have got some stuff in the States.
In the States, yeah.
But apart from that, and like you say, a couple of things on a streaming service, there's no content, there's no product. Yet they've managed to, move their marketing machine to suggest that their system is the best, better system, and should be on things. And this is why we have forum members asking on a daily basis, why have we not got Dolby Vision? I'm not buying this until Dolby Vision's on it. Why? Why are you waiting for Dolby Vision? Because there's no content. And the manufacturers are not going to give away their IP. They're not going to give away to a third party access to the silicon on chip. There's no way they're going to do that, because it then limits what the manufacturer can do, because everybody then would have to toe the line with what Dolby wants, and they don't want that. So Dolby Vision, yes, it's a nice system, we've seen it working, it works, it's an end-to-end solution, which is really quite clever, but at this moment in time I think Dolby just want too much, and the manufacturers are looking at HDR 10 and looking at open source and looking at dynamic metadata and all the rest of it, and thinking, well, why do we need to pay Dolby for this? So I'd be more concerned if I was buying a TV, I had to buy a TV right now, that there will be an update for HLG,
absolutely,
high gamma, than Dolby Vision. Because Dolby Vision and HDR10, there's not a lot between it. And everybody's going HDR10 at the minute.
As far as I can tell, from most of the manufacturers, it seems that an HLG firmware update is in the works, and looks like most of them can do it, and there won't be an issue. So that's good news. Generally, for anyone who owns an HDR TV, that HLG should be a fairly relatively straightforward firmware update. But what that demo showed to me, that the Samsung, it was like a backroom demo Samsung were doing, and it just showed what I already knew, which is when it comes to HDR, the best performing TVs this year have been the Samsungs. Overall, I think, and it didn't look, any different to Dolby Vision. So it also proved what I already kind of knew, which was that, yes, Dolby Vision's good, but if HDR10 is well implemented, it can look just as good.
Yeah, so that was IFA. We're obviously going to come back to it over the next few weeks and discuss little bits here and there, and products that have been announced and the technology and so on. So we will be coming back to it. And also, I think it's about time we probably tell people that CES is coming. We are going to be covering it this year with a three-man team. And it's the first time for Ed to be at CES. I know he's excited about it. We've got some things in the pipeline for Ed to do, which we think will be quite amusing for most people out there, seeing that he is a CES virgin.
Yeah, pop his cherry.
So stay tuned for that, because we are all booked up. We're ready to go. We're ready to go before registration even starts. That's how keen we are this year. But obviously with the show being so close to the new year, and if you think of how many journalists are going to want to be getting on flights and get out there and all the rest of it just after New Year, it's going to be a mad rush. But it promises to be the big show, because as we've seen at IFA, nobody's really announced anything major there, Steve. CEDIA, we don't expect anything major other than JVC doing the US version of the DLAZ one, and maybe a couple other projectors. I think we might see something from Epson and maybe. But apart from that, it's going to be CES. So stay tuned for CES. I think CES is going to be quite an interesting show this year, because we need to see where the technology is going to go. We need to see if Dolby Vision are going to get a foothold, which I think we're all doubting at the minute. So they're going to have to do some work. Looks like being a big show. Now, before we finish, we've got a little bit of a surprise for you. So we have been talking to Wilfred Van Balen, who is the inventor of Auro3D. Now, Auro3D, as a company, have just had a big investment, especially from the Far East, Steve, in the backers getting behind this technology. Wilfred's feeling a bit confident now that he can actually go into the marketplace and challenge the likes of Dolby and DTS.
Yeah, exactly. He's quite bullish, actually. They've had a big investment. It's going to be an uphill struggle, I think. Let's be honest about this. I mean, Dolby and DTS are fairly entrenched, but he's got a good format. It really works. I like his ideas, his approach to the way that humans hear sound. I think is logical.
Yeah,
and makes sense.
It's completely logical. Compared to what Dolby are doing with the overhead speakers, his idea of the 30-degree angle, it rings true.
Yeah, and he's also quite flexible in terms of implementation too. I think he appreciates that if he's going to go head-to-head with people like Dolby and DTS, he needs to at least be flexible in terms of their approaches and their system, so that his can integrate and also play back their stuff as well. So he's looking at that, but he's also looking at alternative ways of consuming audio content, I think, not just movie soundtracks, but also music, and not just what you listen to, but where you listen to it. And I think, he's a really interesting guy, Wilfred. He's a fascinating man, very clever, and has wonderful ideas. And, it's always a pleasure to talk to him, isn't it, Phil?
Yeah, he's very passionate, as you're about to find out, because when we come back from this short break, we're going straight into the interview with Wilfred. So, welcome along to the podcast, Wilfried. And 2014, we visited you over at Galaxy Studios. We made a little video of you giving us a tour of the facilities there. Only 112,000 people have watched that video so far. So, if all 112,000 could go back and watch it a second time, that would be great.
That's amazing.
So, we know all about Galaxy Studios. We know all about Auro3D. But you have a new part of the story to tell us today. You're heading for world audio domination and you want to overthrow Dolby. So tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, of course, that's a big goal. It's not that, let's say, that we want to take Dolby out of the game. Of course, I think it's not realistic at all. But I think, let's say, our product had to offer something really unique. Yeah? And that's still what we have nowadays. Compared to, let's say, the other solutions came on the market with immersive sound. And we feel that we are very proud about our product, and we see as well how the integrations go very easy in all markets. That was always the beginning of the dream, and that's really happening. So it's really becoming an established standard in the meantime, not only in cinema, but as well in other markets, and that was always the goal, that was always the vision.
Now, of course, our listeners, our members are more home audio orientated and looking at Blu-ray and all that kind of thing. But what you're talking about is you've had a major investment recently in Auro3D technology in other markets, which really could push you on to make you Auro really compete with Dolby.
I think, let's say, the concept, myself, I'm coming from content production. Yeah, I'm a music producer and film producer as well. So it was always my dream to share the experience that you achieve, let's say, that you have in a professional environment, that you share that as much as possible, let's say, to the consumers everywhere, not only in the cinema market, of course, at home, yeah. But let's say it goes to the consumer. So wherever of whatever the consumer is, if it is like on his mobile even, yeah, how can we experience that mobile, sound experience then of immersive experience combined with picture, yeah? But how can we improve that from a sound point of view, that you come again closer to that, let's say, to that same experience? Because sound, it's like George Lucas said one day, is at least 50% of the movie experience. Yeah, but it's not only a movie. It's if you have like a soccer game or like an sports in general or whatever, let's say, where sound is involved in such an experience, it makes such a big difference. And the idea is to come, let's say, to bring that experience wherever you are, in a car, let's say, at home, on your mobile, on the move. And I think that was the main goal about it. And that's the reason why it is not only for cinema, of course, although I understand that most of your readers will, the viewers will, of course, be busy in the home theater world. Yeah.
So how can you get an audio experience on a mobile device that can compete in any way with a home system or a large audio system? I mean, how does that experience move between different platforms in a way that the quality remains really good?
We all know the difference, let's say, if you hear in a home cinema and if you experience in a home cinema, let's say, a movie, or you do it, of course, on a mobile phone, that's a complete difference, yeah? That is not only, let's say, because of the sound, it is as well of the smaller screen, you are not in the same isolated environment. So there are many parameters we cannot change. But what I try to do is, of course, let's say, due to the sound making the more sound spatial, it drags you more into the whole story subconsciously. That is a very subconscious process. So if you improve the sound, let's say, and you bring the sound closer, like if you feel like you're in that home theater, that, let's say, that immerses the experience on a different level. So it is really a substantial improvement, let's say, to have that immersive sound coming to headphones. Is this the same experience as over speakers or in home cinema theaters? No. But if it is it a better, or let's say, is a more improved experience compared to what you used to hear on stereo headphones? Yes. So I think that's a little bit the answer how I would position the difference between both experiences.
Wilfred, the funding that Phil mentioned, the $28 million that you've raised in additional funding, is intended to be used for your global expansion. Which countries offer the most opportunities for Auro and why?
Let's say, I think what we have seen already from the beginning, that is, let's say, Asia and America are the fastest moving, continents, yeah, about, let's say, innovation in home theater and in film, or let's say in media in general, yeah. We feel, let's say, like Europe is a little bit slower, and we've seen it as well in the cinema industry. We have seen immediately, like the first install was in Asia already, in China, in Chengdu, already in 2011. And then, yeah, Cinemark, you know, in America, they installed almost like 200 cinema theaters immediately with the Auro system. So it's we've seen, let's say, these two markets mainly busy, yeah. Now, the reason why, let's say, we have a Chinese partner now who bought 20% of the company is mainly because their belief in the technology. Yeah? They believe that our technology is perfect, let's say, in its efficiency as well as its quality to bring as a market in China all over, not in the consumer markets, but well in professional markets. So that's the reason why they embraced our company and our format. And I think that will have its effect all over the globe.
You said that Europe's not quite as fast as Asia and America to embrace Auro. Are there any Auro-equipped cinemas in the UK?
I don't know out of my head. We have, I think, in the meantime, we have like 600 theaters worldwide installed or committed, yeah. But I know, let's say, in Europe is in fact the least compared. Europe, it depends. We have in Russia is moving forward very well, yeah. But Central Europe is not that much, and I think it has to do as well the way that this theaters are installed mainly, and the kind of content they bring there. There's a lot of local content involved, but local content is not immediately, let's say, going for this new format. Typically, they are like more followers. They are not the ones who are picking up as first, yeah. But I know, let's say, about immersive sound, there are more and more theaters installed worldwide. I know together with Dolby, we have already now more than over 2,000 theaters worldwide, which is, let's say, very fast. If you compare it with the integration of 5.1, I think this format in all ways, in every level, not only in the installs, but as well in the content coming, is faster than ever before.
Certainly when you first started in the cinema space, you partnered up with Barco, didn't you? Is that still the same partnership in Asia and America? Are you still partnering with Barco?
Yes, of course. Let's see that you know that Barco is worldwide the leader in digital cinema projectors. Yeah, they have more than 50% worldwide market share of all cinemas, and I think we have about 150,000 cinemas worldwide. Yeah. What I've always seen, and that was the vision of Barco as well, they say we want to deliver the best visual experience together with the best audio experience, and that's the reason why they embraced Auro 3D. They see it as the, let's say, as the most efficient solution, because first of all, it is based on the existing install, yeah, which is not the same with our competitors' format. Yeah, so we add two layers on it, so we have in total three layers, which is giving a very natural spread of sound in the vertical axis. And as well having full backwards compatibility and easy compatible as well as an experience with all the rest of the world. That offer is still there. And let's say, I think that Barco is moving very good forward with it. In the meantime, we launched as well with them together the Auro Max system, which is in fact adding object-based technology on the existing channel-based format. That is now, let's say, it's the ultimate immersive sound system on the market. It is not, let's say, being installed at this moment. We are busy with the first installs. But at this moment, you all know we are busy with, we are working together with the SMPTE, so the standard organization of the film divisions worldwide, to have their standard about immersive sound. And I think that's what the studios really, the film studios, the content makers really want. That whole thing is not a de facto standard, but based on an interoperable format, so that I can play back on all immersive sound systems, and that's what we are looking forward to. So the moment that standard is defined, you will see out rolling out many AuroMax systems.
Now, you said interoperability, but your speaker placement or ideal speaker placement for Auro 3D does vary quite a bit from Dolby's inception for their Atmos system. So how do you, How does that work when it comes to actual theaters?
Let's say from a content making, now I'm going a little bit in detail, but from a content making point of view, it's not that difficult. Let's say in Auro Max, let's say our speaker system, how shall I call it? Yeah, that's, let's say we work as well with the objects, yeah, but more with zones, yeah. And I think if you compare if objects are going around the room, the difference in that experience is not that much. Yeah. We have a little bit more vertical resolution, of course, because we have three layers, where Dolby has only two layers. So we will have as well more ear-level experience, which I always found very important because, yeah, in normal life as well, most of the sound sources are coming from ear level. Yeah. Of course, I understand ear level is not possible in a big theater, yeah, but at home it is. Yeah. So these are like a few differences. And in fact, the main difference is in fact the not the object-based thing anymore, but then the way the channel-based is different. Yeah, you know, with it was always my vision that you first create with channel-based technology a 3D space that has many advantages in the workflow and easy to reproduce everywhere in a channel-based system. So that's in fact what we do. We have in our beds, so in the channels, we have Auro 13.1. which is 7.1 on the bottom, 5 as a second layer, the height layer, and then 1 top layer. Yeah, we keep that same, let's say, that same part as the beds. While Dolby Atmos, for instance, they have 9.1, 7.1 on the bottom, and 2 channels up. Yeah, what I use for the professional format, because at home, the home format is different. They don't have, let's say, the same concept for home. That's just based on the 7.1 and having only the objects in 3D. Now, the objects are, let's say, I think the most easiest one about compatibility. The challenge is more to have, let's say, the channel-based format compatible. And now that's the place where Auro has a big advantage, because the way everything is concepted is like fully easy backwards compatible with 5.1 or 7.1 surround. So in fact, for the creative people, it's more, let's say, they have to understand how if they mix in Auro Max, they can check very easily how it works with two layers, like with the Dolby Atmos system. That means, let's say, our typical standard lower layer, yeah, of the ear level layer, surround layer, like we call it, yeah, or the height layer. You have to find a very easy way to bring them together or split them. And That's in fact the main difference. I hope it's not too technical, but it's understandable what I just explained.
No, I think it really does explain things quite nicely, because obviously a lot of our members and listeners are actually implementing Atmos and DTSX and Auro into their home theatres at the moment. So, there are different concepts on where speaker placement should be in terms of the theatre and the home, and how it you can use the different formats. So it really is quite interesting. That I've got one more question before I go back to Steve, and that is, it's all about content. So when it comes to people like the big studios in Hollywood and Bollywood and Asian cinema in China, as well as production facilities like Skywalker and so on, how do you convince them to mix in Auro 3D?
In fact, it was not that difficult. The moment when they heard the experience, most people immediately understand this is a game changer. So that's what Skywalker Sound immediately said when they heard for the first time Auro 3D in 2011. They said, wow, that is really a big difference, yeah? Because this was not the first format playing around with height, playing around with different systems. There were already other ideas on the market, but they've seen the way the whole thing was concepted as well, the technology to deliver it so easy to the market. Because we are still the only ones who can deliver in the existing formats on the market that whole auditory, if I'd say that whole experience, that whole immersive experience, without any loss in quality. Yeah? So that means for the distribution, like Sony Spider-Man, The Amazing Spider-Man 2, or some other movies, they're going around the world with only one format. It's only the Auro encoded 5.1 format which is being used. So the theaters, we don't have the system, they hear the normal 5.1. The ones we have installed the Auro 11.1 system by Barco, they have as well the decoded version, yeah? So they can hear then the original like it is. So our technology was able to combine in an artistic way two different formats in one existing carrier format. And we do it not only in the professional world, we do that as well on Blu-ray, yeah? So it's a very easy way to combine in the existing bandwidth without any need of change of bandwidth, without any need of change of standards, yeah. And that is still, I think, a very big advantage from our format compared to competitors' format.
So when it comes to a director sitting down and planning out his movie, what incentives are there for him to mix in Auro 3D or other than Dolby Atmos or DTSX or even IMAX, which is different yet again? So, what incentive is there for them to choose Auro 3D?
Now, I think, the main part is about, a film director, his main goal is the storytelling, that his story is coming along across the best possible. And in 2006, I came with the first time to the market with the Auro 3D speaker layouts. And I one of my slogans I said at that time was, the closer we come to lifelike sound, the more immersive is the impact. And I think that's all about the main thing. We try to create a more, the more realistic the whole thing feels, the more our subconscious dive emotionally in that whole story. And it drags you in totally. And that's, I think, the most important thing. And I'm sure, with our format, even if it is with Auro, with a channel-based format, or even with including the objects, yeah, we have the most powerful, system to bring that more natural sound. That's what you see as well if you see comparisons when people many people already installed both systems and they compare it, yeah, even with both different speaker layouts. And what you see from feedback on social media as well, that people say, wow, it's amazing that even Dolby movies or like other movies from other formats, they play back so well over the Auro 3D system, yeah. And I think, if you have to choose between all those formats, what kind of speaker layout to install, I should say, read a little bit what's on the internet available. It will be very easy to understand what's the best choice.
Can you say which studios you're actually working with in terms of Auro 3D and roughly how many films have actually been mixed with an Auro 3D soundtrack?
Yeah, I think all the leading studios in the main continents, yeah, like in Hollywood, yeah, we have there all the big seven studios have the Auro system. Skywalker has three systems. Sony Studios has two systems. Warner Bros. Has two. I think that is like Fox Studios has two. Universal. So we have the support, and Lionsgate is producing movies in. I'm probably even forgetting some of them. But let's say all the major studios are supporting it in the Hollywood scene, but as well in China. China Film Group is the main group there. They support it in Russia, in everywhere around the world. You see, let's say, the Aura 3D is integrated in the, let's say, in the main stages.
You mentioned earlier that there's been Blu-ray releases with Aura 3D soundtracks. And I've also noticed that there's been at least one Ultra HD Blu-ray release with an Aura 3D soundtrack quite recently in Germany. Mm-hmm. Will there be more coming?
Yes, of course. Oh, there's all coming up. And you see, in the beginning, let's say this is coming slow, because I know as well that we are a little bit slower compared to the competitors, let's say, bringing these Blu-ray formats into the market. But it has as well to do with the fact that we have to follow the whole workflow. Typically, it is we have to have installed not only, let's say, in the professional division, but as well in the consumer division. And those people, they are like different parts in let's say different in the company. They are like different people deciding over that, and they want to see as well if there are enough consumer devices before they are going to integrate it. Yeah, but the good news is that, say, in the meantime, we have in the major chip manufacturers, we have our let's say our technology integrated. So, and they're coming now soon on the market with their new models, and you see more and more things coming up, and that's the moment then you will see rolling out much more content as well. What we have now already in mobile, we just have the first 100,000 of mobile phones recently on the market. I think before the end of this month, we reach already more than 1 million mobile phones, and the feedback is fantastic. People say, wow, this is the best audio I ever heard on a mobile phone, yeah? So I think this has all to do with the fact the more, let's say, we can solve the chicken and egg, the more content will come as well to all of this, let's say, all of these formats. Yeah.
At the moment, Ralph, when we look at the consumer market and we look at consumer AV receivers, you're either looking at really high-end products like DataSat and Storm Audio, or you're looking at Denon and Marantz. For access in the consumer market for Aura 3D. Do you see your technology moving out to other manufacturers like Yamaha and Onkyo and so on?
Yes, of course, let's say there will be more from this brands coming up with our technology.
Excellent. So now that we know that that's going to happen, and we're hopefully going to see more UHD Blu-rays with Aura 3D soundtracks and so on, and even music titles. We haven't even touched on music, which is really your side of things, where you really have a passion. Obviously, you created a whole movie music recording studio, so that's really your side of things as well as a movie. So to have that experience at home, we've already talked about interoperability in a movie theater. If I was going to design a home theater now, what would be your recommendations in terms of speaker placement?
It depends a little bit of the size of the room. Typically, what I say to people, if it is only one row seats, then I should keep it discreet, that I would not, let's say, arrays of speakers. Yeah. So that if it is like a two row seat room, so the bigger home theaters, then I should perhaps use already at a size like two speakers or sometimes three. It depends a little bit how big and the size and the distances of the theater. Most of the important things, of course, that ear level is ear level. I think that's very important, and that's something you can achieve at home. That's a little bit more difficult, let's say, in a theater, because you need to have an equal spread of sound. But if you have the chance to recreate ear level sound, you should put your speaker, the axis of your speaker, not higher than let's say 4 foot maximum, let's say 1.10 meters or something. Or 1 meter, because most of the people, if you sit in the seat, it's like only three foot or like something like that, 3 foot and a little bit, yeah. I think that's important. And then if you want a very good vertical spread of sound, you cannot only do it with two layers. I think even playing back other formats as well over a three-layer system with the object is really giving a better resolution of the sound and in the vertical axis, yeah. So anyway, as well, let's say if you have the Aura 3D system, you can play back every kind of format over it. And I think we have to see priorities here as well. What I've seen as a priority first is the screen sound. With Aura 3D, we have a vertical stereo field on the screen. You know that we have two planes on the screen, the normal existing left and right, and above that one, at least height left and height right, but as well for the bigger screen, starting, let's say, from 15 feet or something, you should have as well a height center speaker. That means you have in total 6 screen channels, and they allow a lot of, let's say, more transparency in the sound, much more place for dialogue. You feel that the screen sound is so much more improved, and 80% of the sound energy is coming from the screen channel. So that, I think, where the R3D format has a very big advantage compared, let's say, to the competitor's format, is mainly our screen sound. And then additionally, of course, let's say the spread of sound in a home theater. If it is a small theater, I think you can do it only with 2 layers. You do not need at all, let's say, the overhead of the top layer of the Voice of God channel, like we sometimes call it. I think that's a little bit due to the marketing wrongly positioned. Immersive sound is not coming from above. Immersive sound is mainly coming from, let's say, that vertical stereo field all around us as it is defined in R3D. That's the place where most, signals, source sounds, and their reflections are coming from. And that's where our brain is sensitive for. And if the angle between the lower and the overhead layer is too big, our brain will feel it as too completely, disconnected, or let's say there's no coherence between it. Even if the original signal has a time relation between it, let's say sounds coming from nature and reflections, we don't feel it as related to it. So when that angle is bigger than, let's say, like 30 degrees or 35 degrees, it starts to disconnect already. And for that reason, I think it really makes sense to consider very well the speaker placement. But I think that our format really offers there the best compromise between all of them.
Obviously, one of the suggestions from Dolby for their system in the home has been, if your room's big enough, always go with a 7.1 layer and then add the height layers on. What would your advice be with Oro? Is it the same? Would you go for 7.1, or do you think 5.1 plus the 2 above is enough?
Yeah, that depends how the content is being created, because I still am a big 5.1, believer, yeah? Because, let's say, you can with 7.1, creatively, you can do certain things, yeah? The main difference what I did like between 5.1 and 7.1 is, with 7.1, you feel there is less, the gap between the front and the surround speakers, yeah? There is less that gap, yeah? Because there is a little bit more surround information being spread in a different way. But what I found out is the moment when you add that typical height layer from R3D, then that gap disappears anyway. So I was impressed and there's even about placement, yeah? I play back many content in Auro 11.1, where there's only a 5.1 layer, that a lot of engineers ask me sometimes, but was this now Auro 13.1? Did you have that? No, this is just this was the 5.1 layer. Just because you can position in virtual zones more, right? Yeah. But having said that, I think it doesn't matter that much. I think 5.1 is a perfect system for home, and 7.1, of course, there's... The more speakers, there's more detail, but it does not mean there is more immersive sound. I think I've seen sometimes people thinking that, the more speakers I will have, the more immersive it sounds. I believe the main thing is having that vertical stereo field in front and all around us as it is defined in the R3D speaker layouts. And that's already there in the R9.1 system.
Now, we've talked a lot about film, which is obviously a big push for R3D at the moment. But let's not forget about music, which is obviously your passion, Wilfried.
Yes.
So what does R3D bring to music? Because I still speak to a lot of two-channel fans who, they still stick to two-channel. They're not interested in multi-channel. A lot of them are not even interested in adding subwoofers for full range. They would rather have a pair of four standing speakers. So what would your advice be to them, and what does Auro bring to music?
I think, this is a very important question. And first of all, I'm very proud to say that Auro3D is the only immersive sound format. Immersive sound for me, is defined as sound in 3D. Yeah? So it's the immersive sound format on the market that can support the full workflow. This means we can record and reproduce just in channel-based sound, a 3D space. We can as well do the mastering process. The mastering process is that final process typically in pop music, yeah, where the mastering process has two different things. That's the moment when, let's say, the master is made for duplication, yeah, But at the same time, it's the last phase where the artistic people can touch, let's say, in an artistic way, the sound. Now, mastering engineers are very specialized guys who can give that, let's say, that good, that global gloss, let's say, that final, let's say, yeah. They do that with compression techniques and EQ techniques together. So they blend all the objects and all the sounds more together in one package. Now, that process can never be done in object-based technology. So let's say our competitors' format, they cannot do that mastering process, although it's in the workflow for pop music a key thing to do, yeah? Because that they create, let's say, that typical total overall sound gloss of the sound, yeah? And yeah, that's I think very important already for, let's say, for music in our 3D. We are the only ones who can offer that. But let's say from an experience point of view, I see two different approaches. Our format is the easiest one to recreate and reproduce a natural sound. And at the same time, you can use the same speaker layout as well to do in a creative way so much more things. Yeah. That's, let's say, from the Aura 3D on itself compared to the other formats. Now, your other question was how it relates to the people who like stereo so much. Yeah, I have an interesting story to tell about that. You know, Dieter Burmester, that's the main brand about the best sound for cars. Yeah, you know, the top brand cars like Porsche in Germany. In fact, by the way, Porsche is bringing now their first car with Aura 3D, with Burmester system in Aura 3D already on the market by the end of this year. So Burmester was really, really an stereo freak, yeah? And he was, in fact, people said to me as well, he will be never convinced about Aura 3D. And when he heard the Aura 3D format, he was very intrigued about it. And he said, wow, why is that now? So he felt the same thing as I felt. There's a completely emotional difference in the experience. And it took me some years to understand why specifically the Aura 3D format gives it, let's say, that heightened emotional experience. And Dieter Burmester, after like so many years, when he visited Galaxy Studios and I was talking a whole day and talking about experience and why, after that day, the man was already more, in fact, he was already more than 70 years old at that moment. He told me, you can imagine after being so long in the business as a stereo freak, you changed the vision about it in my life. And that was a very big compliment, because it was very clear to me that even somebody was such a big stereophile, or how do you call it, like a stereophile like him, that he was convinced about the added value in an experience that an Aura 3D system can give. And I've said many times to people, I think that Aura 3D was giving to the world what surround sound was meant to be. I see in the further future, I see two main formats. I think the stereo format and the Aura 9.1 format, this will be two very strong formats. I think that people who have 5.1 will easily expand to Aura 9.1. It's very easy to integrate because, yeah, there's always place about the corner speakers of a 5.1 speaker layout, so it's easy to install the Aura 9.1, and it creates such a completely different experience. And I believe that 5.1 will step by step disappear and going, let's say, to easy install to Aura 9.1. I see already that in broadcast there's a lot of interest to integrate it. And by the end, I think then there will be two main formats out there, the stereo and Aura 9.1.
Excellent. And I've got to say, on the point there about the experience with Aura, going back to our visit at Galaxy, you had an orchestra in who were recording, I think it was a music hall at the time, they were recording music cues. And myself and Steve stood in the studio with the orchestra, in the room with the orchestra, for two cues, and then we came into the control room. And I have to say, that's the first time I've ever experienced an orchestra so close, where you get the sound pressure and you get the emotional response of the orchestra and the music that they're playing coming across. And then when standing in the control room, it was a completely different experience. And I guess with Aura, that what advantage you have there is that you can place microphones in certain areas of that room, and you're not only capturing the performance of the orchestra, but you're also capturing the space that the orchestra's in. And I think a lot of the time that's missing when it comes to two channel. You don't get the sound pressure, you don't get that that envelopment of sound that you get standing next to the orchestra, which I guess is really impossible to do with any speaker system. But certainly in Oro, you got more of that experience coming across.
Exactly. That's very nice explained. And it's about 90% of what we hear around us are just reflections. And our brain is very used to analyze the sound field based on the information coming out of those reflections. That's the same for the colors of sound. Yeah, if you hear an instrument sounding in a certain room, it sounds a little bit different in every room. And it is exactly how you describe it. The moment when you can capture the main reflections and producing them back, it's amazing what it does with our brain and how clarity and transparency is created. And it has an emotional touch. Exactly, it brings our brain subconsciously much closer to the performance of the musicians.
So Wilfred, what does the future hold for Oro 3D?
Yeah, Steve, I think the future is bright for us in general. Because I see, let's say, the integration at this moment is amazing. Yeah? The feedback is really, really good. And what I was always dreaming about is seeing this, sharing this new experience and bringing this third dimension to the world. I think that was my main mission, yeah? Which I see now really happening, not only with the addition of the competitors following as well the same concept, but as well now seeing integrating it all over the line. We see now we have more than 200 international movies now already out, and there are more and more studios are going to be installed. Music, we already more than 400 albums are recorded in our 3D. Not all of them are released, but it's gaining up. The mobile industry is fantastic. How is that moving forward? Yeah, gaming industry is starting. Yeah, the first cars are coming on the market. Broadcast is now with our new partner Jetson there. Barco is working on the next steps. So I'm a very happy man and see this whole thing coming forward. And it's making dreams coming true that makes people happy. And the fact that I can share this now with so many people really makes me a very happy man.
That's excellent. All the best for the future, Wilfried. We really do hope that you succeed with your plans here. And, I think there's plenty of room for all of the different formats, because I think they all bring something a little bit different to the table. So best of luck for the future with your plans, and hopefully we'll catch up with you very soon. Maybe CES, maybe we'll catch up with you then.
To all the listeners, thank you very much for your interest in Oro 3D, and thank you very much as well for this interview.
So it's always good to catch up with people like Wilfried, and hopefully there's something there for everybody to take out of that interview. Interesting in terms of recommendations for setting up the speakers and stuff in a home environment. It's just a shame that there only seems to be Denon at the moment, although Wilfried has hinted, Steve, that there will be other manufacturers with the technology. We haven't seen it yet. There's only Denon in the area where AV Forums members tend to buy their AVRs.
Sure, yeah, Denon and Marantz do offer Oro 3D and have now for the last 2 years. But he did seem to intimate there might be more AV receivers coming on board, which would be good news. There's no reason why you can't, if you take his advice, you can't position your speakers in a way that you can enjoy, this is what I've done, all three of the formats at home, and particularly on the current Denon and Marantz lineup. So, you can have Oro, Atmos and DTSX from a single speaker configuration if you're sort of canny about it. And the results are great. And, why not have all? Why not have it all?
Yep.
Why limit yourself? That's what I say.
So we'll certainly be looking more at immersive audio as we get towards Christmas and the New Year, because we've got all the new AVRs to get through in terms of review. And we're also going to start having a look at some of these speaker packages that are Atmos ready with upward firing speakers and so on. And comparing that with the setups that we have at home, Steve, where we have actual physical speakers on the ceiling, always interesting to see how the other approach works, which is Dolby's approach of bouncing sound off the ceiling. So be interesting to see and compare the differences there and have a look at the product that's on market. But anyway, that is it for the podcast this week. We are back to normal next week with the team, so join us then and do all the usual gubbins, like us and go to iTunes and give us 5 stars and follow us on Twitter and all the rest of it, and we'll see you again next week.